Pseudopod episode 184, March 5th, 2010. This week's story, The Identifier, by Mark Patrick Moorhead. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm Alistair, your host, and this week's story comes to us from Mark Patrick Moorhead, the author of Zombie Proof Fence, a young adult horror novel set 3 years after the Zompocalypse. You can get more at zombieprooffence.blogspot.com. Your narrator this week is a man who knows a fair bit about the undead, the never-living, the unliving, and everything in between. The one, the only, Mr. Ben Phillips. So keep an eye out for those precious trinkets, because I have a story for you. And I promise you, it's true.
The Identifier, by Mark Patrick Moorhead. Brom and Sons Chardonnay, right there in front of me. I glance around, trying not to act excited. Don't see any hoods. The nearest Maurg is two rows away, and none of the others are looking my way. Quickly, without lifting the bottle from the box, I turn it over in my hands. The amber glass feels cool beneath the greasy layer of dust and grime coating the bottle. It's full. Cork looks good. How long did it sit forgotten in some burnout city before they found it and brought it here? I clear a space toward the back of my sorting table by the auto parts bin. It's as far back as I can reach, and enough other crap is piled there that the bottle will probably go unnoticed if I put it there. My hands start sweating, and claustrophobia about overwhelms me when I pick up the bottle again. It's like my wheelchair is a big mousetrap, and I'm pinned by the refrigerator with the lights on, the man of the house stomping toward me with a stick. Smoothly, and I hope nonchalantly, I move the bottle to the table and push some old rags against it. Still no one looking. Leaning back, I relax a little, even though this was the easy part. This is the day, I tell myself. After all this time, this is my day. 2 years. That's how long I've been here. They caught me a couple of weeks after the war started. Damn, it happened fast. They just appeared everywhere, all across the world. One day the price of oil and some brush war were the big news. The next day the world broke and they invaded what was left. Maurg, hoods, and a half dozen other kinds appeared out of nowhere, hitting every continent at once. The hoods are in charge. Always shrouded in thick robes with drooping hoods that cover their heads, no one I've met has seen what they really look like. Gale used to say they were robots, back before they took her away. There aren't many hoods, but they can turn a man inside out with a word. Get in your head and pull out just about anything you know, and it's their gates that move people between their world and this one and probably 100 others. The rest of the fish, we call them all fish, serve the hoods. Loyal like dogs and not much smarter, the other kinds are primitive, medieval. The Maurg who guard us carry clubs and crude knives, use handmade tools, and wear tanned hides. Primitive as they are, they beat us inside a month, and though they don't bring many new prisoners in these days, when they do, it's always the same story. Earth is smashed and the fish are everywhere. Taking a deep breath, I pull the next item from my box, a small pink bicycle helmet. I toss it into the toy bin. A hammer goes into the tool bin, and I set a rusted red toolbox on the table. I should go through it, but I might need it later if I'm going to pull this off. The wine is right there, right where any of them could see it. A powerful urge tugs on me, pulling me to look over my shoulder and see who has noticed. I sort a few more items, going through the motions until my heart stops pounding. Then I glance up and see Randall staring right at me. That suck up. Half the people who get punished around here are ones he rats out. I glare back at him, same as always. If I get demure all of a sudden, he'll know something's up, and that won't do. Still, he's making me nervous. Sweat drips down my back, and my legs hurt. The phantom pain is just nerves. I haven't felt my legs since I was 20. Jesus, I thought that was the end of the world. No one else is looking my way. Haley is chatting it up with Crunchy, one of the meaner guards. Maybe there's some interspecies romance. Maybe she just talks more than the rest of us. Don't know. Don't care. Crunchy is the only Maurg I see, and she's keeping him busy. Skalinda is working through his fourth box. He's the only one I trust. He fought them for 6 months on Earth before they captured him, and he's helped me sneak things out of the sorting room before. The rest stand stooped over their tables, despondently removing one item at a time and placing each carefully in the correct bins, same as always. I pull some old telephone books and empty beer bottles out of my box and toss them in the trash bin. Clearly this crap came from a garage somewhere, probably after the Maurer killed everyone in the neighborhood. Garage junk is usually just that, junk, stuff they've seen before and know is of no use to them. Beneath some newspapers and magazines, I find another surprise. A red plastic gas can. It's just lying there amid the other junk. It takes a moment to get over my shock. Gasoline is serious shit. Something we have that they don't. They check for gas, oil, anything that starts fires, the same way they check for guns. The gas can should not be here. Randall is busy now, going through a bunch of electronics, and nobody else is watching. Not that I can see, anyway. I lift it carefully, giving the can a little jiggle while it's still hidden inside the box. Something sloshes. A cup of liquid, maybe two. Probably water. Lifting it out of the box, I sniff the cap as I turn to place it next to the wine. It smells like gasoline. God, I've been waiting so long for a chance like this. But it might be a trap. Sometimes they test us. Just this year they let a gun in to see what we would do. Some fool tried to hide it and was caught. They killed her. Then rendered three others for not speaking up. Lunch slides by. A cup of rendered mush, still warm. A wooden cup of white, milky water. And a baked stick that tastes like chalky bread. No canned goods today. In fact, it's been a month since the last time they let us have human food. I can already feel the scurvy setting in, making my gums tender. What's next, rickets? The bottle of wine and the gas can are still there, lying out in plain sight. Some hoods have been by, and they neither examined nor commented on these items. Just more junk as far as they're concerned. Scalinda noticed. He gave me a look, I think warning me to be careful since I could get everyone else in trouble. But he trusts me, and I know he'll help when I need him to. Sneaking small items out of the sorting room has never been a problem for me. The wheelchair has a dozen little nooks, and the Maurer don't have a good sense of how things work, so I can just tape things to the chair, and the guards assume it's supposed to be there. I worry about the hoods sometimes, especially Spooky. He's seen my chair every day for a year or more, and I expect that one day he will notice that the screwdriver or box of cookies I've jammed under the seat are not really part of the chair. Luckily, our tools are just too alien for them to really understand, and they're very literal, overlooking the myriad of ways things can be used. Take tape, for example. They have seen tape. They know what it does. But they don't understand how versatile it is, so they ignore it. I don't know who did this first, but for months, several of us have been taping things to the undersides of our tables. They inspect our work areas several times a day, looking in things like jars, boxes, and buckets. Yet not one of them has ever leaned down and looked up at the bottom of the table. I've been saving some things under my table for a day like today. The problem is my wheelchair. I can't get under the table easily, and they're sure to notice if I tried. It's mid-afternoon already. I'm shaking again. Nerves, anxiety. The overseer keeps looking at me. Does he know? Am I acting strangely? Was the gasoline a test? I've pushed it to the back, stacked more junk around it. They'll punish me if I don't call it out. Maybe I should wave Spooky over, show him what I've found. No, this is my chance. I have been stuck here, trapped for 2 years. So what if they catch me? There's nothing to return to. Before they enslaved me, I saw them overrun Denver, and before that, I saw the last few broadcasts of fighting in New York, London, Beijing, Sydney. All of them hit at the same time. The ruddy sun is getting low, the day's last light streaming in from high, narrow windows along the south wall. It's time. The hoods will be back in 15 or 20 minutes to pick up the rest of today's artifacts and interview us about anything new. Then it's back to the cages, and I need to make sure they don't look too close on our way back. When no one is looking, I slip the wine into my chair, propping it between my left arm and the seat back. I cover it best I can with the old blanket I wrap my legs with. Now I set up the table. I slide the gasoline to the far end near the edge, take a few more random things from the box, then tear three strips of duct tape off a roll I keep on the table. One strip on the wheelchair, two on the table. Time to go. Skalinda is sitting on his table, done for now. No Maurg are with him, but Spooky is making his way down my row. He'll be at my table in a few minutes, and that won't work. Now or never. I push the battered toolbox off the edge of the table. It crashes on the floor, popping open and scattering junk across the floor. Old tools, loose screws, nails, washers, and God knows what else. Aw, shit, I yell. There's crap everywhere. I'm not going to miss dinner. Somebody help pick this up. Spooky glances over, and two Maurer guards start toward my table. Skalinda grabs one and points at me, waving at the mess on the floor. It grunts and shoves him toward me. In a minute, Skalinda and Haley are picking up the scattered junk and piling it on the table, while the annoyed guard stands over them. Skalinda crawls under the table, and I nudge the guard. Hey, that needs to go in the tech bin. I point at an electric screwdriver that fell behind him. Though he snorts, and his eyes narrow dangerously, the big Maurg bends down to grab it. Behind him, Skalinda swiftly pulls three bundles out from under the table. It's my stash that's been taped to the underside of the table for months. He sets them on the table and turns back to pick up another loose tool. The guard is still focused on the screwdriver. He's found the switch, but can't get it to go. Sheepishly, the big dummy holds it out. I flip it over, thumb the switch, and nothing. Broken, I say, handing it back to him. Skalinda sneaks a nod, then finishes picking up. When we're done, Spooky drifts over to my station. Folds of soft cloth cover his entire body, and an elaborately embroidered hood hides his face. Just the same, I can feel him staring at me. After several seconds of intense scrutiny, I hear his voice slithering into my head. The intrusion of another mind in your own is the ultimate violation. It's dirty, violent, and reminds you how powerless we are against them. More careful. The two words echo in my mind, promising punishment and pain if I fail to comply. I nod, but don't say a word. He turns away. 10 minutes until the collectors return, maybe less. Gotta hurry. With a push, I roll up to the table and unwrap everything. Two bundles have batteries, 4D cell, 4AA. The other has the circuit board from a kitchen timer and some wire. Using the table to hide what I'm doing, I slide the bare ends of the wires into the circuit board, wedging them into the connections where the speaker used to be. I wrap the wire twice around the board so it won't come loose, then fiddle with the ends until there is just a hair's breadth between them. Finally, I snap two of the AA batteries into the case and set the timer to 5 minutes. No one seems to have noticed, save Skalinda, who is watching me intently. He looks worried and a little sad, his mouth tight and his eyes narrowed. He knows what it means if they connect him to this. He knows I am putting everyone in danger. Still, I see a glint of something there I haven't seen in a long time, and I know he won't let me down. I take one last glance around the sorting room. They keep 24 of us in here, identifying things for them. Some people would say we're traitors, collaborators, party to the genocide of the human species. I don't see it that way. Humanity had been a blazing candle burning bright. They snuffed us out. Simple as that. All that's left is a dying ember and a wisp of smoke drifting away into the night. I figure we're keeping humanity alive, preserving this small bit of our culture and accomplishments before the long good night closes in forever. Turning back to the table, I shuffle some things around, acting busy until no one is watching. Once it's clear, I pick up the gas can. With a twist, the cap is off, and the delicious stink of gasoline greets my nose. God, I hope this works. Shaking now, I slide the loop of wire into the can, then tape it in place so that the wires are a few inches above the liquid. I screw the cap back on, then tape the circuit board to the side. The timer's LCD shows the countdown, just over 2 minutes left. 2 minutes 19. 2 minutes 18. I set the gas can near the edge and watch until the timer drops below 1 minute. Game time. Hey, it's a weapon! There's a weapon in my box! For a few beats, no one moves and all eyes are on me. I wheel back from the table, still shouting. I wave at the overseer and point. It's a weapon! I think it's a bomb, a booby trap! Now they are moving, every fish in the warehouse closing in on my table. A few of the people are backing away now, but most are just standing dumbly at their tables staring at the commotion. I roll back a few more yards. No point yelling anymore. A guard pushes my chair out of the way and moves past me to the edge of the table. He takes one look and orders the others back. He's not stupid. He can see the numbers changing, even if he has no idea what it means. I force myself to breathe. Any second now, as long as they don't mess with it. The guard backs away, looking to Spooky for direction. A sharp pop and a flash startle everyone. The gas can jumps a foot into the air, the cap popping off with a gout of oily smoke. Hardly an explosion, but it does the trick. The can lands sideways and gasoline dribbles out, burning. The pool of flame spreads across the table, igniting other junk, and dark smoke begins filling the room. Spooky whistles something shrill, and the guards start shouting at us. Back! Back to beds! Chaos ensues. Some people run. Some just stand there gawking at the fire. Guards grab people and shove them roughly toward the heavy door that separates the cells from the sorting room. I wheel my chair toward the door, zigzagging between sorting tables and half-full bins. I avoid the guards, careful to never take a line toward one of the outside doors. It wouldn't do the wine any good if they picked up my chair, and even a hard bump could mess up everything. More fish swarm in through other doors, Maurg with spears and swords at the ready, hoods in billowing robes floating behind them. I roll through the door and down the long stone hall to the barracks. I wait at the corner for Skalinda, who is a few seconds behind me. He catches up and drops a folded rag in my lap as he passes. Smooth move, see you on the flip side. I tuck the rag under my blanket and roll through the mess hall to my cell. In a few minutes, we're all locked up. One human to a cell, each door secured by a locked bar. Once we're put away, the guards run back to the sorting room. Just us humans now. It's time. I take out the wine, Skalinda's package, and the big bundle of batteries. Bending around the chair as best I can, I pull a couple things loose from the frame. I have a wine glass, carefully packed in a cardboard box. It's been under there over a year, the box wrapped in duct tape to look metallic. Next, I loosen a boom box that Skalinda helped me tape under the seat. It was there for 2 months. The fish could see it there, plain as day, but like I said, they just don't get machines. Last, I work a corkscrew out from under the armrest. Ironically, it's the most dangerous thing I stashed. To us, it's just a corkscrew, an everyday thing, but the fish would see it as a weapon, a pointy metal object, as dangerous as a knife or a gun, and I have no doubt that they would have killed me had they found it. After the wine has had a few minutes to breathe, I pour myself a glass, just a little, enough to swirl and sniff. Ah, it's sweet. My whole body tingles as I breathe in the aroma. No wine has ever smelled this good. It has a nose of honeysuckle and apple blossoms. From the smell, you would never guess it was made from grapes. I unwrap Skalinda's package and carefully take out a single compact disc. It's old, scratched, and fingerprinted, but it should play. With my sleeve and a little spit, I clean it off, then load it into the boombox. I take a sip of the wine, close my eyes and feel it on my tongue, in my throat, and rolling down into my stomach. It has the mellow smokiness of a wine aged in oak, the deep aftertaste of rich California soil. It's not a fancy wine, not an expensive wine, but it's almost certainly the last wine I will ever taste, and I cannot think of one I have enjoyed more. With the CD and batteries loaded, I refill my glass. The nerves are back, my hand shaking. I jam the cork in the bottle. Skalinda, I whisper. Shh, they might hear, he whispers back. With the wine bottle in hand, I reach as far out as I can through the iron grill separating my cell from the corridor. With my shoulder firmly wedged against the bars and my head pressed into the frame, I can just see the far edge of Skalinda's cell, his arm poised beyond the bars. I swing my arm back and forth a few times to get a feel for the weight and balance of the bottle, then toss it, cringing from the anticipated pop of it shattering against the stone floor. But he catches it. I don't know how, but he catches it. Arm and bottle vanish into his cell. Thanks, man. Give me a minute to pour a glass. I wait, taking long, slow sniffs and a couple delicate sips. Calm, I turn on the boombox. The front panel lights up, a constellation of bright blue controls and an LCD equalizer. I haven't seen artificial light since this all started, and the sight brings tears to my eyes. After wiping them away, I roll back to the grate, the boombox in my lap. When I hit play, the opening chords of the 1812 Overture echo down the hall. I take another sip and let the music absorb me. Ba 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 ba. The sound fills the air, making the dank cell seem cozy and safe. There is another sound, something strange but familiar. It takes my mind a moment to realize that people are cheering. Of course. How could I be so selfish? I turn it up all the way and angle the speakers to flood the barracks with music. It's a full orchestra version with real cannons rather than drums, probably the London Symphony Orchestra. They always did 1812 better than anyone else. The music lifts me up. The conductor turns, raising his baton, then he slashes it down, unleashing the cannons. Boom! I imagine General Kutuzov riding along the lines, rallying his soldiers to stand against Napoleon. If only we had been able to stand against the Hoods and their armies, had our own Battle of Borodino, our own Trafalgar. Will anyone remember our history? Our great battles? Our music? Another boom. Closer. The iron grate snaps open. The Maurg are here. A heavy hand knocks me back. The chair tips over and I fall painfully on my back. The boombox skids across the floor, the final movement still pumping from the speakers. A gray-skinned guard steps over me, swinging a heavy iron ball and chain over his head. The flanged ball, cast in the shape of some dark god, smashes the boombox, filling the world with the silence of old stone. Outside, the song continues, sung and hummed by the other prisoners, the melody broken by cheers and catcalls. Another guard squeezes into the room. I think it's Crunchy. He grabs one of my arms and hauls me up into the air. He leans close, snarling. I think he's going to bite me with those huge teeth. Instead, he slams me hard against the dislodged grate. I feel bones break. Everything goes dark for a moment, but the sound of a dozen singing voices lifts me back. I am now upside down, held by my ankles. They hold me up higher, and I see Spooky staring from beneath his embroidered hood. Though I cannot see his face, I can feel the rage boiling inside his alien mind. Render him. Guards drag me from the cell. Despite the taste of blood from my broken teeth, I can still taste the dry tang of the Chardonnay, the char of the oak barrels, still smell the bouquet of honeysuckle and apple blossoms. Best of all, I still hear them singing, remembering for one perfect moment what they are and where they came from.
A single piece of culture, a single final moment where you draw your name across the world and go, I was here. It's an incredibly compelling question, isn't it? Especially as it asks a second question. What defines you? What piece of popular culture fits you like a glove? The answer is, of course, all of them. Because the beauty of pop culture is it affects us all, even as we affect it. And the horror of pop culture is it affects us all, even as we affect it. For me, though, right now, it's the opening of In the Midnight Hour by Wilson Pickett. There's this moment that you don't notice until it's gone, of absolute silence, and then you get that kind of artfully crumpled horn section, the drums thundering in, and that bass line that's one half strut and one half self-deprecating grin. It's a beautiful, scruffy, glorious piece of music that has that crucial element that so much tries for and so little reaches. Humanity. Not red in tooth and claw, but bright-eyed, charming, and ever so slightly flawed. It's a piece of music I encountered for the first time in a show called Midnight Caller, which I will surely blab about here at some point. Suffice to say that by revealing my deep love for it, I've revealed one of the two pillars of my approach to this job, as well as my eventual secret plan to host a late-night radio talk show, fight crime, and get much, much better at pool. Anyway, moving on, that's my piece of humanity. What's yours? If you haven't already, why not sign up to our discussion board and tell us? If you can, please donate as well. We rely entirely on you to pay our authors and cover our costs, so if you did like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise it's incredibly gratefully received. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. And Pseudopod can't find its way home.